Okay, we're good. All right, good morning, everybody. Hope you had a good Christmas break. And we're back to learn some really cool stuff. That's good. Human physiology. So that's what this class is. Bio 241, Human Physiology. I'm Dr. Gober. I'll be teaching this class, but not the labs. You'll have other instructors for that, but I'll float in and out of the labs every once in a while anyway, so I will be around. And I want to pull up a syllabus. I don't have a syllabus on this computer, but that's okay because you all have a syllabus online because this is a hybrid class. So that's one thing that you should be aware of, that this is not just a standard on-campus class, it's hybrid. We meet almost 100% on campus, but there is some online testing and instruction. Right. So if you're interested in taking this class, you definitely should know that. And you're probably wondering, how do you register for this class if you're not registered already? And this is how you find your way in. You see, we have plenty of seats in lecture, but where we are really impacted, where we don't have enough seats or equipment, is in lab. That is the rate-limiting place. So if you want to add this class, you have to go to the beginning, or actually right before lab, and just make it known to the instructor that you want to add the class. I'll be the instructor there for today. And then the instructor is going to take roll call. If somebody is a no-show, then they're going to get dropped immediately, probably within a couple minutes of the class. So if you're registered, don't be late to lab, because there's a chance you're going to get dropped. It will definitely, you'll be dropped if you're not there. And then I'll add students off the wait list to replace no-shows, and maybe even take some students that are not on the wait list, that are off the wait list. Right. So, but I'll go through the wait list first. That's the deal with that. So the way you find your way into lab, into this class, is by finding a spot in lab. And that's because we have only a certain number of computers and physiologic machines like ECG recorders and things like that. So that's where you have to find a spot. And I take attendance every lecture. I'm not going to take it today because there's a lot of extra students in class, and every lab they're going to take attendance. Please read the attendance policy in the syllabus. That's there for your protection, right? Because if you miss a lot of classes, you don't have a chance in the class. And as a matter of fact, talking about that, look at that weekly study plan and fill that out. I would actually like to see that with every student. I want you to plan your week out. And if you can't find the number of hours, what is it? How many hours a week? I think it's 13 hours outside of class time. Is it 13?
12.
Okay, this semester is 13. Okay, guess what? If you can't find 12 or 13 hours to study outside of class, then you're just going to be punishing yourself and beating yourself up and getting bad grades, so drop the class now. Okay, I mean, that's just the bottom line. You got to find that time to study. And anybody who has passed this class, including me, has had to do that, has had to find that time. So use that study plan wisely. Get that time set aside. And then compare it to what grades you're getting and make some adjustments as you go through the class. All right, so hopefully everybody can adjust to that. All right, so on the screen, actually I'm going to turn some of these lights down a little bit. Hopefully my microphone doesn't go bonkers. I think that's pretty good. What about that one? I think we can you live with that? Is that too dark? You're okay? And I think the screen shows a little bit better. Okay, so since this is a hybrid class, we have a lot of stuff online, and the virtual classroom that we use is Blackboard, and here is the login for Blackboard. And if you see a background that's kind of speckled like this with maybe some embossed plus signs, maybe you can see the plus signs right here, that's the correct URL for our Blackboard. We've had different servers at this college over the years, and if you have an old URL for a Blackboard class, it's not going to work. So you got to make sure that you use the correct one that's in the syllabus, right? And it is what? cypresscollege.blackboard.com. Doesn't seem really complicated, but all the other URLs work. Really similar combinations. It's easy to get confused. So I just would like to know, raise your hand, if you have tried to log into Blackboard but have not been able to. So not into the class, but just Blackboard. Yeah, a couple people. That's usually a really easy fix. I can probably do that in about a minute or so. It's usually because my gateway, which is the registration site, hasn't passed on your password to Blackboard. They're two independent programs. They have to handshake. They're probably not anywhere near each other, right? One probably could be in Indiana. The other one could be in South America someplace. So sometimes there's difficulty passing the passwords back and forth. And we'll just change your password and not even try to figure out why, what happened. We'll just do it, okay? All right, so and that's I think the most important thing that you have to do this week is to make sure that you can log into Blackboard. And as of today, this morning, probably around 1 or 2 o'clock, the actual physiology class was available for you to log into. All right, that's the other thing. But if you can get into Blackboard, then you can get into the class. That's not a big problem. So how do you get into Blackboard? The welcome letter tells you how to do that. You need your student ID number and a password. And so I'm going to put in my student ID number because I need to go get the syllabus since I don't have it on the computer right here. And I probably want to talk about the syllabus. And we can kill two birds with one stone because you'll see how I use, how I get into Blackboard. And look at that, goes right in. Good. Usually when I say it's easy, something bad happens, but not today. That's good. Okay, so over here in the left-hand frame, let me just point something out to you. You see a bunch of buttons. Actually, this is a window, not really a frame. You have personal information. That's the button you would access to change your password. And let's take a look in there. Maybe that's a place where you enter your email address, too. You've got to make sure that Blackboard has your current email address. Well, I don't want to mouse around, but it's probably in there someplace. All right, and I can't change your email address, but you definitely want to have an email address that when I send an email to the class, it comes to you, you know it's there. Put a notice on your cell phone or something, but just check it out, or check it frequently. All right, in the window way on the right-hand side, these are all the classes that you have online content for. And so you see I'm taking a bunch of classes, probably a little bit more than you. Here, this looks good. All right, so I think this, look at what Blackboard does. Here's the CRN number. It gives me the class, but it doesn't give me the day or time of your lab. So I can't tell what lab is which. Here's 7-2, 7-3, 7-1. I don't know which ones are Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, whatever. So when you send me an email, give me the CRN number, because that's how I find you in Blackboard. I mean, I might know you're in the Tuesday lab or Thursday lab, but that doesn't tell me where to go on Blackboard. They're all separate classes. So let's just look at this one. I think this is the Tuesday lab, but I'm not sure. All right, so this is the page, the index page, and I have it set up as the announcements page. You can read some announcements in class, which might tell you what's going to be on the test or a certain kind of study guide or something, just some up-to-date announcement. And, of course, here's the syllabus. Is it there? Indeed it is there. Most of the files are in a PDF format, so you need a PDF reader. Probably everybody knows about that. It's a free download. And I have links in Blackboard if you need to go get it. And a lot of these plugins that you need are free downloads, but remember to get them from a reputable site. Right? So there, if you Google them, you'll probably get 10 sites. 8 or 9 of them will try to load spyware or spam on your computer, so try to download these things from the official site. And what would be the official site for PDF files? Would be Adobe is the manufacturer for that. So just be aware of all those things. Okay, we can open this up by left-clicking with your index finger. That's how you usually mouse around on the web. But if you want to store this, and I recommend that you store most of these files on your computer, you should right-click, which is the button that you usually do not use. And when you right-click on something like this, it gives you a pull-down menu, and it asks you what you want to do. Well, I want to save it on the computer so that I don't have to do this next time. All right, so I'm going to save target as. Windows has a little bit different command. That's the file name that works for me, and where do I want to put it? Let's see if we can get it going into the right spot. Maybe this is a good way, They don't have a spring. Let's see, can I make a folder? Wow, look at that. I can make a folder. Nothing has crashed just yet. I can even see the keyboard right here. Nice. All right, so we'll open that up and let's stick the syllabus right in there. Okay, so now I don't have to go to the internet. If I have video files or audio files or anything like that, go ahead and download them to your hard drive. And that way, if you don't have internet connection, you still have all that material really handy. Plus, it will be a lot faster, right? You don't have to worry about how many megabits per second that information is streaming to you. Okay, so where do we find that? Let's go back to right here, and we have a spring. Oh, I put 14. Is that what I put in there? Did I put 15? Okay. Ah, here it is. I couldn't see it. Okay, here it is, and most computers, you just double-click, but you can right-click once again, and you can tell it what program you want to open it up in, right? So be familiar with that right-click. You guys can tell me a lot more about computers than I can tell you, but anyway, I just thought I'd tell you. All right, so here is the class that we're going to be working on, and I'm going to display this in just one, but it's not that one. It's going to be this one here. So both sides of the class will see the same stuff, at least for the moment. So we got three sections in class. That's me. Got some phone numbers where I'm going to be during my office hours. Office hours are Tuesdays and Thursdays. So you're on campus those days because you have lecture. So that's handy for you. Mondays, I'm in class all day long, so there's no way you can get in touch with me on a Monday. It's really good for you to work on problems out of the textbook. And then when you have a question, come see me and we can talk about it, because there's a lot of questions that I ask you to do that don't have a real clear answer. They're more like thinking questions than something that you memorize. So that might be a little challenging, but don't get too anxious or your feelings hurt if it's not just a really simple answer that you can memorize, okay? All right, your textbook you got to have, and you got to have this today, right? This is required material. In order to be counted as present, you got to be in class the whole period, the entire period, and participating, and that's really there for lab. So if you're going to show up to lab and be there for 5 minutes and then leave because something is happening, guess what? Then you're a no-show. So please be aware of that. Here's your lab manual. All right, so there are too many things I want to go over. Most of the stuff that you'll read on your own. All right, but something that is important that I want to go over is grading. So in this class, we don't have any practicums, no practicums in lab. So there are three items that I'll use to calculate your grade. It's going to be a lecture exam in here, and of course they're always proctored. And you have lab quizzes. Those are always proctored in lab. And all those are going to be closed note, closed books, no internet connection, no lifelines, no nothing, just whatever you have in your mind will work. Sometimes you can have a calculator when you need to calculate pH, for instance, or membrane potential, things like that. So that's a really nice requirement you should work out right away, is a basic, non-graphing scientific calculator, right? So something that you can't put a lot of stuff into, other kind of memory. So your cell phone is probably a really good calculator, but it's way too sophisticated for this class, and it will probably take the test for you. So you can't have your cell phone on during the test, right? So get a non-graphing basic scientific calculator. All right, so we got lab quizzes and the lecture exams, and then a weekly online quiz every week. And every week at Thursday at 11 p.m., that's the deadline for an online quiz. They're not terribly difficult, but you do have to think about them sometime and probably work some questions beforehand. But they're set up so you can take them an unlimited number of times. So if you want to take them 100 times, that's fine. And Blackboard will store your highest grade, which is really nice, but you can only take the quiz until the deadline and then zero times after the deadline, and there's probably no way that I'll ever budge from that, okay? Because it will take some reprogramming, and that's just too time intensive. Question?
I'm guessing that you'll still be able to view the results after Thursday at 11, but you can't take the test, right?
Okay. You can see what your score is. All right, but that's about it. You'll see a whole list of when you took it and the grade that you got for those online quizzes, but you won't be able to go back and look at the questions after that. So those quizzes will go away, but those quizzes come from a larger set of questions, which you will have, right, for the whole semester, or at least until whenever you have that lecture exam. So the online quiz is a small subset of all the questions that you can look at ahead of time. You'll have that whole big set of questions until you take the lecture exam, but not just the 10 or 20 for the online quiz. Okay? Because I want you to know everything, not just those 10 or 20 questions. Okay? But if you have a question, for sure come and see me about that. All right, so online quiz, unlimited number of times. So what kind of grade should you get on the online quiz? 100%. Yeah, absolutely. And you can get a 90%, 80%. That won't affect your grade very much. But what will affect your grade is if you get a zero, right? You cannot average a zero away. You can average like a 50 or a 60% grade, but a zero is just going to sink you in here. So you definitely want to take every single online quiz. And when is the deadline for that? Every Thursday. Okay, now this Thursday, that deadline's coming up really fast, so I put it off till next week. So the work for this week will be due February 5th. Right? And then the week for the following week is going to be February 5th. So you're going to have like two quizzes. And there's also an extra credit quiz on the syllabus that's going to be due on the same day. So there's actually three quizzes the first time. So you're going to be really familiar with mousing around, figuring out how to take these quizzes. And here is a really important point. When you submit a quiz, it's going to be graded before you can even get to your gradebook because it's just done electronically like that. But nonetheless, you have to go into gradebook and check to make sure that you got credit for taking that quiz. Because every once in a while, somebody will log on, take a quiz, complete it, get 100% on the quiz, and Blackboard will have no idea that you even logged on and will not give you any credit. And if it passes the deadline, then you get a zero on that assignment. The types of machines that will do that, unfortunately for you, will be mobile devices. You can log on to Blackboard, work with Blackboard with a cell phone, other kind of mobile device, mobile web browser, but they do not interface with Blackboard well enough to let Blackboard know that you logged on and that you actually took this quiz. All right, so please, every time you take a quiz, just double check that your score was properly recorded in your gradebook. All right, so if you took a quiz and it's not recorded, and then a week or two later you come to me and say, oh, I know, I got 100 on that, but it says zero in Blackboard, there's not much I can do about it because I don't even have a record that you attempted to log on to Blackboard even, right? So always double check. Anybody have a question on that? Submit an online assignment, always just double check when you submit it that it got into your gradebook. And that gradebook is easy to find. All right, so every Thursday, and since this no Thanksgiving this week, then, I mean, this semester, you don't have to worry about that. But you have spring break, no deadline on spring break. All right, so that's just a free week for you. Typically, we can't make up tests because the class is just moving too fast. If you need a makeup, you just get so far behind in the class that there's no way to make up that ground. So the grading scale of all the points that you can get in the class is just 90, 80, 70, 60 for A, B, C, D. And F. And sometimes I put the points range for these different grades, but sometimes the number of points in a class changes. And I would like to have that flexibility throughout the semester, so I can't tell you that you need a certain number of points to get an A or B, but I can probably come close if you want to know. All right, but I can't guarantee if I do a calculation that if you get a 78 on the next test that you'll get an A in the class. Some of you will be able to do that, but I can't calculate it exactly because the number of points floats around just a little bit. Okay, academic honesty. I am really happy when somebody asks me to write a recommendation for them that I can put down on their recommendation form that they are trustworthy during exams. That means that they're a mature student. They don't have to rely on anybody else, right? That's the kind of person that an employer wants, right? So when you're taking a test, make sure you don't look around the room. Or try to use your cell phone inappropriately, things like that. There are penalties to that, but the biggest penalty is people will learn not to trust you, right? So that's really the bad thing. So pay attention to that. If you're doing a online quiz at 10:30 and your internet connection goes down and you can't finish it by this 11 p.m., then that's still not a good reason why you need a makeup for that online quiz. If you have equipment malfunction, then that just kind of adds up into your score. So get this work done early. Make sure that you know how to work your computer and your online connection so that you don't ever miss a deadline, an online deadline. Okay? All right, so how is it that you can be assured that you will never miss a deadline? There's something that's really easy to do. What's the technique? Okay. Oh, you guys are really good because I hear a lot of answers at the same time and I can't figure out what you're saying. Go ahead, tell me.
Don't procrastinate.
Don't procrastinate. Oh, that is so cool. That is really good. As a matter of fact, you know what? If you just stay 1 week ahead, just 1 week ahead with your online quizzes, and the week comes up, right, and you need to submit this quiz on Thursday, and all of a sudden something happens that you just have to attend to, like a friend might call me and say, hey, we need a fourth person to come shoot some pool or something. Well, I'm going to forget about this quiz coming up, and I'll go shoot some pool, and then I go, oh, I missed the deadline. But I don't have to worry about that if I just stay 2 weeks ahead, right? So if I'm just ahead of the schedule, I can miss one quiz, and it's already done, right? So just try to stay 1 week ahead, and then you'll never miss a deadline, right? So that's really good. Or on a mirror someplace with a crayon, write down, Thursday. Hey, well, there's two things you should have on that mirror. Did you back up your hard drive today? That's the first thing, right? And the second thing is, did you submit your quiz this Thursday? Right, so just make sure that all those things are done. Who's lost a hard drive and lost a lot of information? Oh, wow, I see a lot of hands. Yeah, okay, so don't do like an online quiz deadline because that happens. Try to stay on top of that. There are various computers around class. All those computers will work with Blackboard very nicely. We're not doing anything really special. Blackboard doesn't need a lot of cache in your computer or access to your computer. You can work with Blackboard very nicely. All right, please read all this stuff. Here's a little policy for recommendations. Just read through that sometime. Maybe look at this ahead of time. And, you know, I write a lot of recommendations. Maybe get to know your instructor a little bit during the semester. That helps instructors write good recommendations. But, you know, if you're doing stuff outside of class, like if you've organized a study group with a couple friends and you're getting together studying, let your instructor know about that. Right, because what does that demonstrate? Little initiative, leadership skills, right? All that kind of stuff. That's good. All right, here's more stuff we don't have to worry about. But what we're getting to here is a schedule. I believe the schedule is really good. Right, even April 26th, yeah, that's the last date to drop with a W. So all these dates are pretty accurate. It's hard for me to get this 100% accurate. But I think it is this time. If you see something strange, let me know, and I'll try to correct it. But the way this is set up, right, we got 16 weeks, so we're going to have 16 different rows right here, and we're going to have two lectures every week, Tuesday and Thursday. And the first lecture right here is going to be on just introductory material on physiology, like what's the difference between anatomy and physiology, maybe some stuff you know already. Right, we'll go over that really fast. And the reading is chapter 1, right? And then we're going to move to chapter 2. And we got three lectures on what? What does that look like? That looks like chemistry to me, and indeed it is, all right? Chemistry is not a prerequisite to this class, but it is an advisory. It's an instructor advisory. I do not recommend that somebody take this class without passing with a C at least one college-level chemistry class. Okay, it's not that something that you will learn in there, some little bit of knowledge that you need for this class. It's just, I don't know, it's just something that happens to all our brains when we take a chemistry class. Right? It just gets better, more efficient, our way of thinking. It just helps us out in physiology very nicely. Every student that has taken my advice, guess what they have said? Every student that went out of their way to take a chemistry class before physiology, even though they didn't want to, and they told me afterwards, guess what they tell me? You know, they just tell me thank you. So everybody has really appreciated that good advice. Okay. And if you're the kind of person, when I say you've got to take a chemistry class first, and you kind of cringe and say, oh, no, I can't take it. I hate chemistry. Guess what? You're exactly the person that I'm talking to, right? Okay. So just be aware of that. And, okay, so when is your first test? Yeah, February 24th. And is what day of the week is that? Okay, so we got Tuesday, Thursday, right? Tuesday, Thursday. So that's going to be on a Tuesday. And what chapters are going to be on that first test? Yeah, 1, 2, 3, and 6. Kind of a strange combination right there, but indeed that is it. In Blackboard, it will tell you exactly what page numbers you need to study, what end of chapter questions you need to look at, where the online questions are that I really like, and what figures in the textbook I think are important for you to memorize. Because sometimes I'll take a figure from your textbook and put that on a test, and that could be maybe anatomy, but usually I don't put anatomy, but I'll put a flow diagram or a concept map or a response loop or something like that on the test, and you have to then match it with a word bank. Right? All those things are going to be in Blackboard for you. That's in the exam study guide. All right, so you got to become familiar with the exam study guide. It would be really good if you were to print out for chapter 1 and 2, 3 and 6 maybe already and just become familiar with the material that you have to look at before the first exam. Because here is the big deal. When I write an exam, guess what I use to write an exam? I go to the study guide. right? So there's just a one-to-one mapping between the study guide and what is going to be on the test. And of course, what's in the study guide is what I think is important in what you're covering in lab and lecture, right? So use that really efficiently to get a good grade on the test. Test number one typically is the hardest because people haven't really learned how to study for this class yet. So really prepare for that, especially if you do not have a background in chemistry. Right? Chemistry can be really abstract for some people and hard to think about. All right. So I see a couple different colors right here, believe it or not. I see like a yellow here and a yellow here. Okay, and then I see another color down here and another color down here. And one reason why I'm kind of mentioning that and laughing is because I don't really see these colors because I'm colorblind. So you could ask me a question regarding color, like a diagram or something. You could say, oh, what's this green thing and how does it relate to that? Well, you know, I have no idea what you're talking about. And of course, if I ever describe something to you in color, then you have to realize I have no idea what I'm talking about either in that regard. So you got to pay really close attention to what I'm saying. All right, but I think here is pretty easy. The yellow lines mean that your test is going to be on a Tuesday, right? And this other, what is this? Is this pink or blue or is blue? Okay, it means that your exam, your lecture exam is going to be on a Thursday. And some of you have labs on Tuesday, some on Thursday. So when you have a lab and a lecture exam on the same day, that might be a little bit challenging. So what I've done, okay, since we have four exams, how many exams are on Tuesday? How many are on a Thursday? Two, right? So it's spread around evenly for everybody, right? And okay, May 21st, that's your last day in class. That's a Thursday, so that has to be your last exam, right? And then I kind of work backwards from that, right? Tuesday lecture exams, Thursday lecture exams. So that's easy to see. They're in bold as well. Okay, any question about the schedule? You shouldn't get lost in class. Now, I said this is a tentative schedule, and chances are it might change during the semester. That's another reason why you should come to a lecture, right, to figure out if there's any changes in the schedule. And then down over here, we're not going to talk about this. This is the lab schedule. And I don't think anybody misses any labs. We've got a couple holidays on Monday, but nobody goes to lab on Monday. So everybody's going to get all of these points. Sometimes in lab, you do get an extra credit drawing, right? So you get a blank piece of paper and you got to draw something out, concept map, flow diagram, maybe some physiologic principles overlaid on some anatomy, right? So I want you to know that by memory, and you'll get some extra credit points for doing that. That will be at the end of lab. Most instructors do it at the end of lab. So you have the whole lab period today. So does anybody know for this week what the extra credit lab drawing is? Yeah, the response loop. That's right. Maybe we'll get to that today, as long as I stop talking about some of this stuff. Okay. Anybody have a question on Blackboard or syllabus right now? Blackboard or syllabus? No? Okay. If you can't log into Blackboard, you can email me. Usually I can do this remotely. I've been so busy the last couple days that I don't think I've responded to hardly anybody by email, but I'll be able to catch up on my emails right away. Yeah?
I noticed that you're using an MP3, I'm guessing, recorder.
Yeah.
So are you going to post those on Blackboard as well?
No.
Okay.
They will be online, but they won't be in Blackboard.
Okay.
Mostly because it is DSPS compliant because I have a transcript. So I have a text file of the audio file. So if somebody's hearing impaired, they can at least read it. So it's something I could put in Blackboard, but I think I elect to put it on my own personal website because the college does have to buy space in Blackboard. It does have to buy memory locations, and audio files are pretty big. Right? So, and if I have video files, they're going to be off campus as well. Okay. Which then kind of goes back to a previous point I made. Audio file, it's not as huge as video, but it's still going to be between 15 and 20 megabytes. And you can stream that lecture off of that website, but it's not a streaming server, so it might have some hiccups. So what's the best thing to do?
Right-click,
download it to your hard drive, okay, and then play it. You might have to update your media player. I like, it's just an audio file. It's a WAV file, not too complicated, but What's a really good plugin for media files now? What's the latest and greatest? It used to be DVX. Does that ring a bell for anybody? Okay, it's not that old. Okay, there's a lot of much older things than DVX. DVX is pretty modern, but there's even some that are better, like VLC. Is there anything better than VLC out there now? Anybody know? You could tell me after class, okay, or send an email out. And those are free plugins. Hardly take any system resources, very powerful. Can play almost any format at any time. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. Mostly they are in your textbook, but when I say you're going to have an extra credit drawing, I'll somehow massage it in Photoshop or whatever to get it exactly the way that I would like for you to think about it and email it to you and probably put it as an announcement on the announcements page in Blackboard. Yeah. So most of the time it's going to be in your textbook. That would be a good place to start, but sometimes I massage it just a little bit. Yeah. So you'll have usually plenty of time. Yeah.
Generally, what are the range of points that you would give an extra credit?
Not two handfuls. Probably not one handful, but some portion of a handful. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that. Ah, but the syllabus quiz, the one right now, I don't know, what is syllabus? Is that 10 or 5 points right now?
Four.
It's 4. Strange number. Have no idea how it could be strange. Okay, and it's the syllabus quiz, so just have a copy of your syllabus someplace. You don't need a hard copy. If you're used to working out of your laptop, that's great. Right. If you take notes out of your tablet or laptop, that's fine. I think, oh no, I don't use any text files in here. It's mostly PowerPoint. But I think it's not too difficult to edit PowerPoint slides. You can layer text over it if you want to without too much problem. Okay. So you're welcome to use computers in here, but not during a test. Okay. Now, online quizzes and tests, it doesn't matter what you use. Okay. Use any kind of resource that you want. All right. Well, I guess I have another question for you guys, since you're a little bit more modern than me. In anatomy lab, we look at some cheek cells. The first lab, like, harvested some cheek cells, stained them, and I asked the class, well, if you want to see what a cheek cell looks like before you do it, just so that you kind of dry lab ahead of time, how would you find out what should a cheek cell look like with methylene blue and a microscope slide and all that kind of stuff with the kind of microscopes we have? How would you find that information so that you're familiar with what you're looking for? What would you do?
Online.
Yeah, I Google it, look online. Who likes something better than Google? Anybody like anything better than Google? No. Wow, that's like the oldest. I don't know if anything, that's like the oldest one too. Okay. But anyway, if you have some insights on that, let me know sometime, or the class know. Say that again?
Well, you can use Bing, but
Bing. Yeah, okay. Yeah, usually Google works the best. Even though it copies information somehow about you or another. All right, so that's the syllabus. I might have to go here to see where the PowerPoint slide pops up. Okay, put this away here. Put this away here. We don't want to reboot the computer, please. Go away. All right, so most of my lecture, sometimes I draw on the board, sometimes I work off of a handout. Most of the time, I'm going to be working out of these PowerPoint slides here. You don't need to have a PowerPoint program, but you do need to have a PowerPoint reader program. They're free. If you have a PowerPoint program, that's a little bit better because you can tell your printer how you want it printed out. And I think 2 slides per page is very efficient. You probably don't need it in color. I don't care about color. Some people print them out 4 slides per page. That's a little bit small to see some of the detail. If you're going to print it just in black and white, that 1 per page is probably really nice. Then you got a lot of room to write some notes on it. But if you're using your home printer and you're going to print it out in color, I wouldn't print 1 slide per page. You'd go broke printing it out. All right, so first slide. Everybody ready for his first slide? Here we go. Okay. Oh, what was the title? Study of body function. Yeah, that's physiology, right? Body function, the study of function is physiology. What is the study of structure called?
Anatomy.
Yeah, so here is, well, this doesn't have anatomy on here, but we should probably start with that. Physiology is the study of how pieces function together, and anatomy is simpler than that. It is just what pieces make something up, right? And anatomy is fundamental to physiology. So it's really good that you have a background in anatomy before you embark on physiology. And as a matter of fact, you should know the pieces of your automobile before you try to figure out how to operate it, right? If I say, turn your headlights on, and you don't know anything about the car, and you grab the steering wheel, what's going to happen? People are going to laugh, right? So anatomy is a really good place to start. You all have anatomy under your belts, and you should make sure that you can review your anatomy when we start talking about physiology. When we start talking about physiology of the heart, make sure you know, how many chambers does the heart have? 4. Okay, that wasn't very loud. How many valves does the heart have? That wasn't very loud either. Okay, so that should like be really, really loud. How many sides does the heart have? 2. Wow, guys, got to go back. I hope you have your anatomy book still. How many circulations, major circulations in the body? 2, yeah, because you have a right and left heart, right? Okay, so be familiar with that. So physiology then is just understanding how these different pieces function to maintain a healthy state or to maintain life. Pathophysiology is just a study of processes where that function no longer can maintain life or moves it away from a place that we call normal or what we call a set point. So a set point is just some normal value of some physiologic parameter in your body that you shouldn't deviate very much from. We could think of one of those parameters to be temperature. You don't have to think about it. It is one of those parameters. And what can you tell me about your body temperature? If it's freezing outside, you go skiing this weekend, right? Does your body temperature go to whatever the environment is, which is below freezing? No, right? It stays warmer than that, right? If we go out in the desert, Burning Man, really, really hot, does your body temperature increase? Hopefully not. It does for some people, unfortunately. But it should be maintained within a normal range to support life, right? And does anybody know what that number is, the exact normal value? Okay, in centigrade, you know what it is? Nice. I don't know what it is in centigrade. What it is in Fahrenheit. Yeah, 98.6 is a good value, right? That is absolutely normal. You don't have to be absolutely at normal to be healthy. That temperature can go up and go down a little bit, but it can't vary to a large degree. Oh, sorry about that. That's a bad pun. It can't vary a lot, right, to maintain a healthy state. So pathophysiology is just the study of how physiologic processes are altered by disease or injury. And if we understand something about that process, then we can help bring somebody back into what we call homeostasis, bringing all these physiologic parameters back into that normal range. All right. So here's a question for you. I got to get my cursor back. Sorry. I don't mean to be waving that around all the time. Visible. Good. So anatomy will determine the physiology, or the structure will determine how something functions, right? So we have to know all the chambers of the heart, valves of the heart. You know all the valves of the heart, then you know blood flows through the heart in one direction, not backwards. And another example, for instance, would be this hand right here. It's very similar to the one over here. And you'll notice that I have all 10 of my fingers. I'm really proud of that because I grew up in a machine shop and punch press and all that kind of stuff. So this is marvelous, and I'm really glad because, for instance, if I injured my hand and I lost this thumb, I changed the structure of my hand, what would happen to my hand in terms of the physiology? Yeah, the function changes. I wouldn't be able to grasp anything, right? So we have to know the anatomy of something to understand the function. And if the structure changes, so does the physiology. So here we have pathophysiology, which means that there is some functional change compared to some normal state. So if the physiology changed, what can you assume? What can you tell me? Let's go back the other way. If the physiology is different, if the physiology is abnormal, what can you tell me? The structure has changed from whatever it should be, right? So if physiology changes, that usually means some structural thing has changed. And it can be the structure of a molecule, for instance. So not just gross anatomy, but all the way back down to, all right, even the molecular level. Okay. Scientific method. Let's talk about this a little bit. There's one really important point that I want to make with this scientific method. We start scientific method trying to prove some knowledge. We'd like to know if some knowledge is accurate. And we start this process out by just kind of walking around the world and observing an event over and over and over again. And it seems like there is a pattern, that something always happens as a result of something else. There's a cause and effect going on. And then you come up with a guess as to what the relationship is between the cause and effect. And we call that a hypothesis. Right, so a hypothesis is just a guess or an educated guess about how the world operates, how the natural world operates. And a hypothesis is not something that you can count on because it's just a guess. Right? But a hypothesis is very special because it has to be stated in such a way that it can be tested so that you can actually find out if the hypothesis is correct or not. And we usually do this by using some kind of experiments. And we get results from the experiments, and then we can analyze the results from the experiments and compare it to our hypothesis to realize if our initial guess was correct or incorrect, or to what degree it was correct, or what circumstances it was correct. And if a number of people perform those same experiments the same way, and they all come up with the same results, then that hypothesis can then be accepted as being accurate and true, and then it becomes a theory. Right? So a theory is the result of testing a hypothesis, right, and realizing that it does give us accurate and true information. Right, so hardly anybody says hypothesis because it's such a big, long word, but a lot of times you'll be walking around with a friend, or you might say, hey, you know what, I've got a theory about something. And you'll say, well, you know, if we get over to the shopping mall on Thursday at 6 o'clock, we'll be able to find a place to park. Okay. So somebody says, I got a theory about this. Now, is that really a theory because they're guessing at something? No, that's really a hypothesis. But you can't just walk around saying hypothesis all the time because you don't have time and it sounds weird. But just remember, a hypothesis is a guess, but if you can prove that hypothesis, then it becomes a theory, right? And so a theory then is just a general statement explaining some natural phenomena, which is based on scientific evidence, right? Testing that hypothesis, we call that a proven hypothesis. So there are some steps in doing this. It's kind of complicated. So it's difficult to come up with a theory, because you have to go through the scientific method to get to come up with a theory. But why is it important to develop an idea to the level of a theory? Why? What's the whole purpose of a theory, coming up with a theory? This is probably important for you to know. Oh, because it's a basis of moving forward, of acquiring other accurate information. Yeah, that's really good. I like that idea. And that also means then a theory is reliable information. It is information that you can rely on. That is really the important thing. So people put up with a scientific method. It's expensive. It's time-consuming. But it gives you reliable information. That's the big thing, reliable information. Okay. Does a hypothesis give you reliable information? No, only that theory does. All right. So we're testing a hypothesis. For instance, we might want to look at a particular pharmaceutical, a particular drug, and let's just say maybe it's an estrogen of some kind. Does anybody know what kind of chemical estrogen is? Kind of similar to testosterone. How would we talk about estrogen? Okay, yeah, it's a hormone. Yeah, I like that. So it controls a lot of things inside our body. All right, and usually when we think of chemicals in here, we're going to think of chemicals that can dissolve in water, and others will dissolve in oil. It's like two totally different worlds. There's a water world inside your body, and there is a lipid world, lipid or fat, oil world. Okay, and estrogen belongs to which one of those worlds? Okay, it's a steroid, so it's actually more like a fat than anything else. It doesn't dissolve in water. And so, yeah, we call that, a nonpolar compound. Water is a polar. We're going to spend a lot of time with this. It's going to be really important for you when you go into pharmacology later on. Really handy way of thinking about things. So if somebody is going to be administered estrogen and we're going to give them a shot, can we take that estrogen and put it in water and give them a shot? No, because estrogen won't dissolve in water, right? If you have butter, you can't, on your coat or something, you can't get rid of that butter with a wet washcloth, right? You need other material like a detergent or something, okay? So you have to dissolve that estrogen in an oil. Okay, and then give the shot. So when you're administering that estrogen to somebody, they're not just getting estrogen. What else are they getting? They're getting oil. Yeah, they're getting that oil shot. And you know what? Oil has some estrogenic properties. And so you're going to be really interested to know if when I give a shot to somebody, we're measuring the results due to estrogen, or is it due to the, what we call the vehicle, right? The instrument that's delivering this pharmaceutical agent to somebody. So we need to have something that we call an experimental group, and we need to have a control group. So usually there's, in the scientific method, we have a number of different groups, people that are getting the treatment, and then another group or another couple groups that are getting everything except that one special ingredient that we're looking at. So in this particular case that we're talking about, the experimental group will get a shot of estrogen dissolved in some oil. And what about the control group? Will they even get a shot? They should get a shot, right? Because just by giving a shot to somebody, that's going to change the results. Okay, and so they're going to get a shot. And what should that shot be? It should be everything that the experimental group got minus the estrogen, right? So they got to get a shot of oil to know exactly what's happening with estrogen. Okay, and there's something else too. It says right here, these should be performed blindly. This is really difficult to do, especially in education. That just means that who's ever administering the shot should know nothing about the experiment that's taking place. Right, because they might have some expectation of the drug. They'll be enthusiastic when they give a shot to somebody. That might have some influence, a psychological influence, and there is a huge influence on psychology when we treat people, as opposed to when that same person gives a shot of oil, they know and expect not to have a result. Their attitude, their demeanor will be different. That will change the results of the experiment. So who's ever doing the experiment should not know anything about it, and that's what we say blind. It should be performed blindly. Right. And then the results should be measured using some kind of quantitative measurement, using a nice instrument that can be calibrated. And then that data can be analyzed using statistics. Right. So if we use instrumentation, if we have a quantitative method and we can use statistics, what that does is that has a way to remove bias, personal bias from the results, which then makes the theory better. Right, that makes the results better, and then you can then get to a theory a lot faster. Okay, so those are some important steps, right? The control groups, quantitative measurements means something you can measure, not just say warm or cold, but you could say what, 10 degrees, 15 degrees. And then we can apply that to some statistical method that will eliminate bias from understanding what those results mean. Let me look at what the next slide is. Okay. So here's a good question. Every once in a while I put a question on a slide and says, what is the purpose of the scientific method besides wasting money, wasting time, and having people get all kinds of shots that they don't need? What's the purpose of this scientific method? It gives you reliable information, right? That's what you want. And if you have reliable information, then you can use that to move to another principle. You can build on that, right? So it gives you information that you can build upon. That's huge. All right, in the last point about theory, you're going to run into a lot of really strange concepts in this class, right? This is a class about how you function, and you're going to look at your body in ways that just look really foreign to you, right? Every cell in your body acts like a battery. You probably never thought of yourself as a battery before, but you're going to have to, right? And so what I want to point out to you, everything that's in your textbook, we understand to be at the level of theory. It's reliable information. It doesn't get into your textbook unless it is a theory. If I hypothesize about something, give you a guess, I'll let you know that it's just a guess on my part, but it's not a theory. But if it's in your book, you can count on it to be reliable information, right? So that's kind of why I got into scientific method a little bit. So pay attention to what's in your textbook. It's not just a bunch of really weird stuff, and I certainly focus on things that you will use, right, in your clinical practice forever. Good stuff. I won't be having you waste your time with a lot of stuff you don't know. Uh-oh. Do you hear me still? No? You do? Ah, okay. What color light is that?
Red.
Ah, red is bad. Red means that the batteries are gone. Okay, so I have to speak up. Did I tell you I was colorblind? I forgot.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I need help every once in a while. So maybe I can switch the batteries out as I talk, maybe not. I'm not sure. Okay. All right, so next topic, homeostasis. This is kind of a, I'm going to see if I can find some batteries. Kind of a funny topic, strange topic. All right, because here we got some batteries. All right, so homeostasis is a concept that we use to find out or to think about somebody's physiology and how it's maintained so that it produces a healthy state and not a disease state. Right, so it produces a healthy, compensated state, and it keeps you healthy. All right, so it's a condition in which blood pressure, pH, temperature, these are all physiologic variables, fluids, the water balance inside your body, other factors. Oh, what could be another factor, a physiologic factor that your body is going to monitor all the time and make adjustments so that it doesn't change very much, like temperature, I have that here, and blood pressure. Anybody think of another item? Blood glucose. Yeah, that should be like everybody's favorite. Just earlier today, I forgot about that. That's probably one of the most important things. Your blood glucose can go up and down a little bit, but it can't vary to a large degree because then we know that to be a pathologic condition called diabetes, right? And glucose is an important energy molecule, has a lot of other influences on your body. But energy is probably the most important thing. Oh, let me turn this down before I actually plug it in. This is good. Right on. We're good. Okay. That's nice. Okay, so homeostasis. Condition in which blood pressure, blood glucose, for instance, maybe blood sodium, blood magnesium, blood chloride, a whole bunch of chemicals in your blood, pH temperature, and other factors of your internal environment, things that are inside you, are maintained within a range of values suitable to support life. So these variables, or like temperature, it can change a little bit, but not a lot, right? If it goes too high, that's called hyperthermia, that's lethal. It goes too low, that's hypothermia, that's lethal as well. How do you stay within a normal range to produce a healthy state? So your temperature goes up and down. It's not absolutely constant. Actually, that would be a bad thing if it was constant because that would imply that you're dead, right? You don't want to ever be there, right? So they call it a dynamic state. So homeostasis is a little strange because we say it's a dynamic state, but we also want to remember that it's what? It produces some constancy inside your body. So it's a strange concept where things should remain almost constant, but still vary, but vary only a little bit. Right, so it's a dynamic state where all the body's systems are working and constantly adjusting to the changing internal and external conditions. Right, so homeostasis is just a way to keep things within a normal range. And the very center of that normal range is what we call the set point. And for temperature, we said what the set point was 98.6. You could be 98.2, still be normal, but not exactly at the set point. And your body is going to figure out a way to get your body back to 98.6 from 98.2. And when it does, you might go up to 98.7, and then your body is going to figure out a way to get it back down. Right? So your temperature is going to go up and down, up and down, up and down. And other physiologic parameters are going to have to move around and compensate, right, so that temperature doesn't change very much. Maybe tell me, what would happen if your body temperature increases? What's something that will change in your body when your temperature increases? What could happen? You start sweating, right? That will cool you down. The water will evaporate from the surface of your body. That will take heat from your body. All right, so now your temperature is normal. Now what about your water balance? You've lost water. Okay, so things, all these parameters are kind of swinging around each other. I think of homeostasis as a dance of all these parameters, right? Things are going up and down all the time, not absolutely constant, but nothing changes to such a large degree that it produces a disease state. That's like the most important concept. I'm going to have to say that again when we're done with this lecture. Okay, so how is this homeostasis maintained? Through reflexes or response loops. Here we have some long-range reflexes. We're going to look at some particulars. We have, for instance, an endocrine system. We have a nervous system. And then we have a combination of both of these two things. right? In this first condition, we have a cell, right? And it can monitor its environment, measure something internal inside the body, and it's going to want to make an adjustment in some other part of the body. So it sends a signal, a chemical signal. It synthesizes that signal, that chemical, and it is released through some kind of secretory pathway into the extracellular space, and then that molecule moves by diffusion into the blood. And when that signaling molecule is in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere in your body, or everywhere that blood goes. Blood goes most places in your body. Right? And then when it gets to another capillary, it can diffuse out into some extracellular space and some other tissue, and then it can have an effect on that particular tissue. And we would call that a target tissue or a target cell. That signaling chemical or signaling compound, if it's secreted by the cell and is distributed by the blood, we call that a hormone. And we also call this cell an endocrine gland. So an endocrine gland is something that synthesizes a hormone, and that hormone travels to a distant location, specifically by the blood, where it can have a specific effect on some target tissue or target cell. But to be a target cell or target tissue, and you might want to make a note of this, that cell or tissue has to have something special. What does it have to have? Yeah, for instance, if you want to be sensitive to light, what do you have to have? You got to have sensors for light. That's right. So this cell or this tissue right here can only be a target tissue if it has a receptor to that particular chemical. And we're going to see what the relationship is between receptor and whatever binds to it. So that hormone has to bind to receptor. What it does, it changes the physiology of a target tissue or the physiology of a target cell. So we're going to spend a lot of time looking at that in this class. So we call this a hormonal system, right? So here we have an endocrine gland. Here is a neuronal system, and these are what? Long-range reflexes. Here we have a nerve cell. You're going to love nerve cells. They do a lot of amazing things. They send electrical signals long distances very fast. When an electrical signal reaches the terminus of this neuron right here, it releases a compound, a chemical signal, sort of like this endocrine gland right here. But this chemical signal does not go into the blood. It just moves around by diffusion very short distances. Right, and then that chemical can bump into another cell, and if that cell has a receptor, it will change the physiology of that cell that this chemical compound was released from the neuron. All right, so this neuron or effector cell has to have a receptor as well. So for an endocrine gland, it releases a hormone, but the chemical that's released by a neuron is called a neurotransmitter, because it's going to be transmitting information from the neuron to this target cell or effector cell. So that's a little bit different. Now here is an interesting case. Here we have a neuron, and maybe you're aware that the hypothalamus and pituitary do this kind of thing, some other places in the body. Here we have a neuron, and it's going to synthesize a signaling compound when the electrical impulse reaches the terminus of this neuron, it releases that compound, right? Just the signaling compound. What did we call that signaling compound in this case over here? Neurotransmitter, right? Neurotransmitter comes from a neuron. Here's a chemical coming from a neuron. But in this case, that compound is absorbed by the blood and is carried everywhere in the body. Well, now what does that look like? Does that look like a neurotransmitter if it gets into the blood and distributed all over the body? No, it looks more like a hormone. So what the heck is that? Huge confusion. Looks like a neurotransmitter, looks like a hormone because it has components of each, and so that kind of thing we call a neurohormone. And we're going to look at some of those as well. We're going to look at hormones, neurotransmitters, and neurohormones. And in a lot of classes, even anatomy and physiology, we don't break the endocrine system down from the nervous system. We think about those just in one chapter, and we would call that the neuroendocrine system, because there are a few special places where they are unified. They work together. All right, but in every case, each of these cells over here, target cell, effector cell, or target cell over here, they have to have something special so that they can monitor the levels of a hormone or a neurotransmitter or neurohormone. And what does that special thing have to be? What is it called? A receptor. That's right. That receptor can be in different locations that we're going to look at. It could be inside the cell or outside the cell.
In your third example, would epinephrine or
in certain circumstances. For instance, like from the adrenal medulla, yes. Okay, but if it's going to be a neuron-neuron synapse, then no, then it's acting norepinephrine purely as a neurotransmitter. Okay, but if it's the adrenal medulla releasing norepinephrine, which gets picked up by the blood and distributed everywhere, then it has characteristics of a neurotransmitter and a hormone. We would want to really call that a neurohormone. Okay, some short-range reflexes. Here we have just a cell, and it synthesizes a compound, releases it under certain circumstances, and it diffuses very short distance to a target cell. And why are we calling this a target cell? What does it have? A receptor to this agent right here. That's what we call a paracrine. Okay, an endocrine is something that gets into the blood. A paracrine is something that just moves by diffusion short distances. All right. Here is kind of a strange scenario, but here we have a cell, and it wants to regulate itself. It wants to undergo autoregulation. So it's going to secrete a signaling compound, and then it's going to bind to a receptor on that same cell that secreted it and affect the physiology of this cell. And that's what we call an autocrine agent. It doesn't have to go anywhere. It just goes back to the cell that secretes it. So that seems a little funny. Right, but that's pretty important. All right, so those are some signaling compounds. Let's look at an example of homeostasis. And so this isn't really labeled in terms of any kind of parameter, but you could consider this to be blood pressure or temperature or blood glucose or water concentration, salt concentration in your body. Right, and let's take a look at what's happening here. So we have, you know, this is sort of like a graph. And in order to understand a graph, there's something that you should appreciate right away to make it easy to understand. Does anybody know, when you look at a graph, what are the things that you should look at right away to understand what's going on there? The axes, that's right. You want to look at the axes. And on this graph, there really aren't any axes, but we can kind of pretend there are. There's this horizontal axis. What would be the horizontal axis here on this particular graph? It's going to be time. Yeah, it could be x, but let's say it's time. Right, so time is increasing as we move off in this direction. And then on the vertical axis, it's just going to be some kind of quantitative scale of whatever we're measuring, maybe temperature or blood pressure. Right, and if you go up in this direction, that means that parameter is increasing. If we go back down in this direction, it means it's decreasing. So it's not a very complicated graph. It's just some measure versus time of a parameter. It could be blood pressure or whatever. All right, so what can you tell me about this parameter? I just want to be really general right here. What can you tell me about this parameter? Is it absolutely constant? No, it's going up and going down all over the place, right? It's constantly moving. Okay, but if we look at this, right, the movement of this particular parameter, when it deviates positive, what happens to it? It moves back down. And when it deviates down, what happens to it? It goes back up, right? So that's important to know. And we see that this deviation is not wild. Right? It happens under a very normal or just a small range of values. And if there's ever a deviation from this, what we call the set point or normal value, then it goes back down. It could undershoot or overshoot, but it always goes back down to this set point. All right, so this is homeostasis. Parameters will change up and down all the time, but they're eventually going to be forced back down to this normal point. So we got a normal range, we got an average point right here that we call the set point, and then, okay, I see some of these circles. What do you see inside that circle right there? A negative sign, okay? And that just says that there's a special kind of feedback mechanism that is taking place. And we call it a negative feedback mechanism because the response that's being produced with inside an individual will subtract from the stimulus. So here we have a stimulus of increasing, well, we could say blood pressure, right? And your body is going to change something, produce a response that's going to subtract from this increasing blood pressure. All right, so if it's going to subtract from increasing blood pressure, means it's going to decrease your blood pressure, which means what? That blood pressure is going to go back down to the set point. All right, so a negative feedback mechanism, right, will always force that parameter back down to that normal set point. So when you say negative, what kind of connotation does that have? Negative. You want to be around negative people? No. Has kind of a bad connotation to it, but in terms of feedback theory, negative feedback is the kind of feedback that maintains homeostasis, which maintains a healthy, compensated state in somebody. Okay. As opposed to positive feedback. If it was a positive feedback mechanism, whenever this parameter started to increase, it would get higher. And as it got higher with positive feedback, it would get higher. And then higher and higher and higher again and again and again. So if this was temperature, for instance, if your body temperature increased, some physiologic mechanism would happen, if it was positive feedback, to make your temperature even higher, right? And if positive feedback was still maintained, your temperature would even get higher, you'd become hyperthermic, right? And then eventually what would happen? You explode in a big ball of flames, okay? So that's not a healthy disease state. Of course, that you could find cases in the internet, but that doesn't really happen, right? Okay, but nonetheless, you do get hyperthermic, and it can be a deadly circumstance. Okay, so homeostasis is being maintained by what kind of feedback loops? Negative feedback loops, right. Okay, here's a little bit more detail. I don't know if this slide is in your textbook or not, but that's the one I gave you. All right, this is a really important flow diagram or concept map that you should know about response loops. Hey, what time is it? 12:28? What time are we done? 12:45? Good. Okay. All right, so let's look at this response loop, okay, and in particular, this is a negative feedback loop. We're going to look at, let's define what the components are. Well, in order to have a response loop, it always starts, as a matter of fact, you learned this in anatomy. What does a reflex always start with, and what does it end with? It starts with a stimulus, something happens that produces a response, right? So stimulus starts something that produces a response, and that's the end of what a reflex is, okay? So here we have something, X, for instance. Oh, was that previous slide labeled X? Somebody said X. I called it time, but you could call it X. All right, so here, what is the stimulus in X? Is it constant, decreasing, or increasing? Yeah, arrow's pointing up, okay? It is increasing. You will have no idea that X is increasing unless you have a sensor. Yeah, got to have a receptor. Call it receptor, sensor, whatever. So here you have, on this part of the slide, you have sensor number one, but what should you really have first here? Some books are kind of sloppy. You should have stimulus, right? Got to have stimulus. You can appreciate that stimulus only if you have a sensor for that, right? But that sensor is going to be usually far away from some place in your body that can make sense of what that information means, so that sensor has to send information to some place in your body that can make sense of that information. That place is called the integration center. How information goes from the sensor to the integration center is a pathway, and that could be, what, an efferent or afferent pathway?
Afferent.
You're right. I had to think. It was a long Christmas break. Yes, afferent. Afferent means going from the periphery, for instance, into the central nervous system, right? Entering your central nervous system. So in this example, the integration center is going to be in your central nervous system, and it's going to take that information. It's going to compare it to something to know if this parameter X right here is normal or not normal, and that is the set point. So the integration center has what that absolute normal value should be, for instance, 98.6. And if the sensor is telling the integration center that temperature is 98.6, what does the integration center do? It just takes a coffee break. Everything's fine, right? It just kind of ignores that information, right? But if there is a difference between what the sensor is sending in and what the set point is, then the integration center has to make a decision on what to do. So it integrates the information up, compares it to the set point, and also makes a decision on how the body should perform for compensation. Makes a decision, sends the decision out, right, to an effector organ that's going to carry out the wishes of the integration center. Right? And so how does that information get from integration center to the effector? Via an efferent pathway, right? Afferent brings it in, efferent takes it out to an effector. And then the effector is going to produce some kind of response. For instance, if this is a muscle right here, what is the response that a muscle produces? Contraction, right? And in so doing, maybe a little bit of heat, but in this particular case, contraction. And so that is the response. And in this particular case, I see the arrow going down. So it's going to cause a decrease in this parameter X. Now, what's the relationship between the stimulus and the response? Let's put these arrows together. Do they add together or do they cancel out? They cancel out. That's what we call negative feedback. And when they cancel out, let's take a look and see what happens. So here we have X increasing. We see it on this slide right here. Yes, it is increasing, increasing, increasing. At this time, information is being sent to the integration center. Integration center is going, whoa, something strange is happening here. We got to change something. Something changes, and then that parameter starts to decrease back down to the set point. Okay. So, and then this process is going to continue over and over and over again. All right, so if you see a change in some parameter, okay, but then it's forced back down to the set point, right, and even if it overshoots or undershoots the set point, but it goes back to the set point, there's something that you know about the feedback mechanism. It's either going to be positive or negative. If something is always forced back down to the set point, it's going to be negative feedback. So anytime you see this kind of graph right here, you're going to assume that homeostasis is being maintained via a negative feedback loop. And a negative feedback loop just means that the response subtracts from the stimulus. Right? For instance, if this number 2, if the arrow was increasing, what kind of feedback loop would that be? That'd be positive, right? When the response adds to the stimulus, that would drive the system farther and farther away from the set point. Okay, so that is a nice feedback loop. So question is X constant over time? No. It's just maintained within a normal range, above and below what the set point is. That's how we maintain homeostasis. And all the parameters in your body are doing that. They're going up and going down, but none in a very large degree. Right? So think of it like a dance. So make sure you can break down that response loop into these components right here. This is your drawing for week in lab. What does a response loop always start with? Look, got it right here. What does it always end with? A response. Okay, so let's look at this a little bit more. A stimulus is going to change some physiologic parameter in your body. You'll know that it's changing if you have a sensor or receptor, and then it's going to send that information to the integration center via an afferent pathway. Yeah, it's really afferent, but I say afferent so you know, in the back of the room. I know how you guys are in the back of the room over there, so I say afferent. Okay, integration center. What's cool about this integration center? All right, integration means it analyzes the information, but maybe not just from one sensor, but maybe from thousands of sensors, right? It adds all that information together. That's the integration center. So that's analysis, but that's not all that it does. Compares it to the set point and then makes a decision. This, I don't know if it's in your textbook, but that's what's happening inside the integration center. Makes a decision, sends that decision out to some effector organ. That decision gets to the effector organ via the efferent pathway, motor pathway, I suppose you could think of that as well. The effector then produces a response, and if it's going to maintain homeostasis, right, what should the response, what's the relationship between response and stimulus? They subtract, right, and then you have a nice negative feedback loop. Okay, and that's going to, what is that going to maintain if this is a nice negative feedback loop? Homeostasis. We're going to learn about some response loops in your body that utilize positive feedback, and they're normal, but there's not very many of them, and since there's not many of them, it's kind of fun to think about them. Okay, but usually for maintaining homeostasis, then negative feedback loops are used. So here, response loop always begins with, ends with a response. Okay, we talked about this pretty much already, but here it is in text form. Negative feedback, right, even if it's negative feedback, this is a good kind of feedback. It maintains homeostasis, right? So any kind of body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is made smaller or is resisted. Negative feedback leads to a compensated state, a healthy state, and maintains homeostasis. Right, the response subtracts from the stimulus, moving that system back to whatever the set point is. Positive feedback, the opposite of that. Body mechanism by which any change from ideal normal value is made greater. Positive feedback leads to a decompensated or disease state, and it moves that parameter, it moves that system away from homeostasis. Right, so away from homeostasis is disease. Away from homeostasis is decompensated. So the response then adds to the stimulus, moving that parameter away from the set point. All right, let's change the topic just a little bit. We're still talking about homeostasis, but we want to know of some some classes of homeostasis by looking at some regulatory mechanisms. We sort of looked at this on those first couple of slides. But one way we talk about it is intrinsic control. I'm going to mention this way later in the class, but I want you to refer to this slide. Intrinsic control is built into the organ that is being regulated. So the sensor is in the organ. The afferent pathway is right inside the organ. The integration center is inside the organ. It doesn't have to go to the brain or anything, right? Since it's in the organ, it doesn't have to send the signal anywhere. So there's really no efferent pathway. The organ itself can produce a response that subtracts from the stimulus. And a really super example of this, really important, is the Frank Starling law of the heart. When we get into the heart, this is going to be really important. Intrinsic, because when the amount of blood changes going into the heart, the way that it contracts automatically changes. So that when more blood flows back to the heart gets stronger so that it can pump that extra blood that's getting back to it. That's what we call the Frank Starling law of the heart. It doesn't need the brain, doesn't need neurons. The heart will just take care of that all by itself. But that also means when blood is not going back to the heart, if we withdraw blood from the heart, guess what happens to the heart? It gets weaker. So when more blood goes to the heart gets stronger. When less blood goes to the heart, it gets weaker. So sometimes that's beneficial, sometimes that's actually harmful. And the way we treat people is determined by this Frank Starling law. So you're just going to have to stay tuned for a couple months to see that. But that is adjusting the strength of contraction of the heart, which is being done all inside the heart. There's no, the receptor is inside the heart, the effector is inside the heart, integration center is inside the heart. That's what we call intrinsic control. Okay, extrinsic control means that some parameter is being regulated and adjusted using other parts of your body, other parts of your anatomy. It's going to require nerves carrying information. It might require spinal cord or brain, which is at a distant location. Here is a pretty good example. All right, and here we're looking at temperature on the vertical scale versus time. Right, and here is body temperature decreasing. So there are temperature receptors all over your body, but in particular the brain. There's a set point inside your brain, and that means there's an integration center, so your brain knows that your body temperature is decreasing below the set point. Brain makes a decision on what to do to maintain homeostasis, and that is to contract muscles. Muscles contract, uses energy, right? So that puts heat into your body, and when that happens, then that drives the temperature of your body back up to the set point. And it might actually overshoot, and when the temperature receptors in your brain realize that your temperature is increasing above the set point, it's going to make a decision to compensate for that by, for instance, sweating. And then you sweat, and then you get cold, right? And then this process is going to happen over and over and over again. So what you should see automatically by looking at this will relate to this question. Is this positive feedback or negative feedback on this slide? Nice negative feedback mechanism. Maintaining homeostasis because temperature never goes outside this normal range. And there's that question for you. What type of feedback is operating? If something is always going back to the set point, that is negative feedback. But in order for this to operate, okay, it requires more than the brain. It requires what? It requires muscles and other parts of your body, not in your brain. It requires sweat glands that are in your integumentary system. So it requires all kinds of organs all over your body, not just one specific point. And that's what we call extrinsic regulation, extrinsic control. If it's only one organ, one location, that is intrinsic control. And we have intrinsic and extrinsic control systems all over our body. Let's take a quick look at this. Yeah, we can. This is a really complicated slide, but I think you can analyze this slide really fast. How do you look at a graph first? Axes. So over here we have a time scale on the horizontal. Kind of strange, but we're going to call this a zero point in time. We're going to change something there. And then on the vertical scale, we're going to have a measure of glucose concentration in the blood. Right? Somebody's favorite physiologic parameter. Should be all of ours. Right, milligrams per deciliter, it's okay if you don't know what that means. That's just a concentration of glucose that's in your blood. And as we go up the vertical axis, that means the concentration of glucose is in, yeah, it's getting higher, increasing. So if you want to draw a little arrow right there, I wouldn't mind if you were to do that. Like, it's signifying increasing in this direction. Well, we're going to measure somebody's blood glucose. Suck out some blood. We're going to do this for you guys, too. We're going to suck out some blood from you, measure glucose in your blood, write that number down. And here I can see it's just under 100. And over here, it's just under 100. And what can you tell me about blood glucose concentration in this part of the graph? Fairly constant? Is it changing a lot? Is it changing drastically?
No.
Hardly changing. I can't see it on this particular scale. It's not changing very much. But at this point in time, all right, we're not going to do this to you, right? But this got done to somebody. They got a shot of insulin right at this particular time. And I'm not sure everybody knows what insulin is, but insulin you could think of as a passport that will allow glucose to enter cells inside the body, right? If you want to get into another country, for instance, you have to show them a passport and then you can enter that country. Insulin is that passport for glucose to enter cells. And if insulin isn't present, there's no passport, where is glucose going to stay? It's just going to stay in your blood. It can't go anywhere. It can't go into cells. But if we give that passport to everybody inside the body, glucose is going to be taken up by cells rapidly, right? And if glucose is taken up from the blood, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It's going to drop, right? And this is pretty drastic. This is beyond the normal range. Right, so what is your body going to do if this is a healthy person and all of a sudden your blood glucose drops like that because of this insulin? This is just a little trick we played on your body. There's going to be a receptor for glucose in your pancreas, and pancreas has a set point. It's going to say, oh, your blood glucose is way below what it should be. We've got to figure out a way to bring your blood glucose back up to normal, and you see that. Yeah, I see blood glucose going back over time, right, about 120 minutes or so, back up to this normal set point. All right, so what kind of process is being shown right here? Or the best question is, what kind of feedback is being used? That should just pop right out at you. Positive or negative?
Negative.
Negative, that's right, because any deviation then is resisted, right, and is moved back to that normal level. So nice negative feedback mechanism. We've got to look at the details of this throughout the class, but I at least want you to be able to look at this graph by inspection and very quickly tell me if it's positive feedback or negative feedback. That is fantastic. All right, so we're going to finish up next time. Don't forget, if you need an ad code, it's right at the beginning of lab, and I'll see you guys up on the third floor, like right in just a couple minutes. Third floor, right by the elevator. I think it's 316 or 318, but it's right next to the elevator.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah.
A teacher can never say it's okay to leave class early. So I don't want to. Let me turn this microphone off. Good, it was working.